The new book I hold in my hand, Subtle Acts of Exclusion, How to Understand, Identify, and Stop Microaggressions, is a handbook to help individuals and organizations recognize and prevent microaggressions so that all employees can feel a sense of belonging in their workplace. Our workplaces and society are growing more diverse, but are we supporting inclusive cultures? While overt racism, sexism, ableism, and other forms of discrimination are relatively easy to spot, we cannot neglect the subtler everyday actions that normalize exclusion. Many have heard the term microaggression, but not everyone fully understands what they are and how to recognize them, and ultimately, how to stop them from happening. Enter Dr. Michael Barron, a social scientist and senior partner and digital solutions lead at InQuest Consulting. He is the co-author of the new book, Subtle Acts of Exclusion, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you on the program. So the obvious first question is, what is a microaggression?
Yeah. So a microaggression, what people have meant by that is those times when people aren't necessarily intending to do harm to someone or to exclude someone. That's not their intention, right? They might be trying to tell a joke or to ask a question or to bond with someone or even to compliment someone. But the impact on the other person is very different, right? It makes the other person feel excluded or devalued or, you know, really just bad, and might perpetuate systems where people with marginalized identities are continually excluded. So that's what people have meant by that term, microaggression.
So how does it differ? And I apologize for being for asking if this is a dumb question, but I mean, it's different than being overtly aggressive, but it's still aggression. Right. But it's still an aggression, right?
Well, it can be. So there's a whole range, right? So sometimes it can be aggressive, and sometimes it's really not at all. Let me give you an example.
Are you telling me that wasn't a stupid question? Because that's
not,
very
not
nice.
A stupid question.
Yeah.
At all.
Okay.
there are
no feel
stupid
better,
questions.
Oh, there are, so but go ahead.
This is a good example, right? I was doing an interview with a blind man, and he was talking about how he would walk down the hall at work, and he could sense people silently flattening themselves up against the wall to get out of his way. And he said, I know they're just trying to be helpful. I know there's nothing aggressive in that. If anything, they're trying to be really helpful. But what that does is it makes it so that I feel like a burden. I feel not normal. And actually, what would help me navigate the hall easier is if they just said, hey, Bob, and then I could navigate the hall. I could feel normal. I might have something I want to talk to them about related to work, and I could bring it up. You know, so that to me, that's on one side of the spectrum where it's really clear that there's nothing aggressive in that. And yet it's still making people feel bad, feel not valued, feel like a burden. And so that to me is a good example. And then there's a whole range, right? Some of them are aggressive, and many of them, even if the intent is not aggressive at all, it feels aggressive to the people who might experience it multiple times in a day or in a week.
So let me back up to your example of the blind man walking down the hall. So that person may feel that way of that when people are backing up to the wall, that he feels and sees that as a microaggression. However, not everyone may feel that way, right? I mean, other people may think, well, why, you know, why are people backing up against the wall so I can get down? Right. I mean, is that harder to figure out because you don't know how the individual is going to react to it?
Absolutely. So this is all about how that other person feels. It's the impact on that other person. So like you said, not every blind person's going to react in the same way. Not every blind person's going to want the same thing. Not every black person's going to feel microaggressions in the same way. Not every woman's going to feel microaggressions in the same way. Not every Jewish person's going to feel microaggressions in the same way. Of course, this is complicated stuff. And the point is not to create some sort of objective declaration from on high high that like this is a microaggression and this isn't, but rather to create a deep understanding of what people are tending to feel in order to create a kind of culture where we can just talk about these things a little more openly and transparently and build more trust and inclusion so that we can have conversations like, hey, did that make you feel bad? No, it was cool with me. Okay, awesome. Or, hey, this made me feel, you might not have meant it this way, but this made me feel a little bad. Oh, okay, let me try to do that better. Tell me more about that, right? Just a culture where we can talk about these things.
Well, that makes sense, right? And of course that makes sense. Communication is always good when we have that openness, which of course takes time. And then everybody says, well, everyone's rushing from one thing to another. And do you have the time to do that? Of course we do, but we may not feel that we do. My question to you is in setting up a climate in an office or in an environment, any environment, what should the first steps be? Because and I ask the question because is it up to obviously it's up to individuals, but there's also a climate, right? There's also a culture that is brewing there that has to be addressed as well.
Yeah, that's right. So we like to look at, you know, for example, at an organization kind of holistically and really think about what needs to happen in terms of like policies, you know, that where we need to create more equity and what needs to happen in terms of also creating this culture like you're talking about. And so the first step in that, as we see it, is, okay, well, we need to first get everyone on the same page with what we're even talking about. What are these microaggressions, or as we like to call them, subtle acts of exclusion? What are they? Let's build a deep understanding around what people are experiencing so that you can even recognize them when they happen, right? If they happen to you, you likely recognize it because you feel it. But if it's happening to someone else, you might not even recognize it. And we need those people to be able to speak up and support their colleagues too. We need men to speak up to other men if a man does something that is a subtle act of exclusion towards a woman, right? We need these allies. We need everyone involved in this. And so what we like to do is build that understanding for what these things are, what different people experience, and then really practice how do you have productive conversations if you're the person who experienced the subtle act of exclusion, if you're the person who said it, or if you're just the person who maybe observed it happening and want to speak up and support people as an ally. And if you practice all those roles, it's really helpful because sometimes you're going to be in different roles, right? Like I might experience a subtle act of exclusion at one point because of one dimension of my identity, but then I might be the person that says the microaggression at a different point because of my identity. And so we need to practice all those roles and all kind of think about this as a project that we're doing collectively. We have decided as an organization that we want to talk about these things. We want to have a culture where they don't happen. We want to build trust. We want to build authentic relationships. So we're going to work on this together. And that changes the whole dynamic.
What is the role that should be placed on the one who is excluded? Meaning, how much is there a pressure on them? In this and in the handbook, I mean, are we looking at what is their role in coming forward and saying, okay, this is hurtful to me, or for us to intuit that so that they don't have to have another awkward interaction?
Yeah. Well, you know, ideally we've built up an understanding so people aren't doing this as much and where they might even recognize a subtle act of exclusion when it comes out of their mouth before anyone even says anything. We've all had those moments where you say something and then you're like, wait a minute, that might have not been the best thing to say. And too often, though, we let it slide. We're like, maybe no one will notice.
Yeah, like, you can hear mine daily, Monday through Friday, 9 to noon.
Yeah. But of course people notice, right? So you can even call yourself into that conversation. And, you know, we're certainly, what we're not saying is, well, if you experience this, it's your job to always be the one speaking up, right?
Right.
You may have tried speaking up before and gotten a really bad response, or you might be exhausted from this and not feel like speaking up, or you may be at risk if you speak up. There are a lot of people that have told me, for example, hey, there are things I want to speak up about, but I don't want to get stereotyped as the angry Black woman, and so I'm not going to do it. And so that's why we really put a lot of focus on allies being able to speak up for other people, too. People who might not be at risk in the same way if they were to speak up.
You talk about these things of common scenarios, and I just want to get back to it for a second, because it's just, it's things that I think people can really understand of asking a man with a ring on his finger what his wife does, or scheduling work meetings on Yom Kippur, saying to a coworker who is young, wow, you're not like other millennials. Now, those seem, in some ways, they're harmless. On the face of it, I'm sure the person saying it maybe believe that they're harmless, but obviously they pack much more punch. But it gives us a sense, to me, in my reading of this, is of not a an old school versus new school. And is this meaning? It seems to me easy to put it into a category where it's generational, where it probably isn't, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, right? How these things change. I was talking with someone yesterday about this. In some ways, you move from, you know, explicit gender roles, right? Men are only allowed to marry women, and, you know, the woman's role is this. You move, at first, it's explicit. And then we get a new sort of understanding that that is not right, that's not appropriate, that's not equal, that's not equity. And so explicitly we have this idea that that shouldn't happen, but then it kind of goes under the surface where it's just more about what's considered normal or what's considered right or what's the thing you do without thinking, right? Like asking a man with a ring on his finger what his wife does. It's just an assumption of heterosexuality. And so where I see us now, hopefully, is getting, if we really want to move to a place where everyone is equally valued, considered good, considered normal, allowed to be an individual for real, where we don't have this idea that there's one way to be normal and everything else is okay and adds a little diversity, but it's not exactly normal. If we want to move to a place where we're really doing it for real, we've got to talk and look at all these more subtle things and interrupt them and change the norm of how we interact.
And we are assuming that we want to do that, but then that gets into the cultural question, because we're learning now very loudly and very clearly that not all of us want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. It's true. Although in my, you know, I find in my work, most people do want to do that. There are some very vocal people who do not. But for most people, they're trying to be the best people they can be.
Oh, sure.
They really do want that to happen. And sometimes it just might be a lack of familiarity with people who are different than them along certain dimensions, a lack of comfort, and maybe some unconscious biases, some cultural conditioning they didn't even know they had. And we all have that, right? It's hard to grow up in this culture and not have some of these unconscious biases. We all do. I mean, I see that now. I have four kids, and I saw that when they were little, reading them kids' books. Oh, you know, all these kids' books that either make an assumption about heterosexuality being the norm and the right thing and the good thing, or they're explicitly trying to do the opposite, yeah. which ironically kind of still sends the same message, right? That when you're like, this different type of relationship is okay too, it's still kind of sending the message that it's different,
right?
And it's not exactly normal. And so it would be impossible for kids growing up these days to not still kind of have that unconscious bias that heterosexuality is the norm, right? People approach my kids even when they're little, like, oh, you have a girlfriend yet, buddy? Or like, oh, the boys are going to go crazy for you, right? There's still all those assumptions. And so we have a lot of work to do. We need to think short term about what to interrupt immediately and do differently. And we need to think long term about the kids who are being born today and what kind of world they're going to inhabit and what kind of messages they're surrounded by on a daily basis. Because that all impacts how their brains are being built right now.
The book is fascinating and very important. It is titled Subtle Acts of Exclusion, How to Understand, Identify, and Stop Microaggressions. It is published by BK. Michael, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Be well. Best of luck in your work. Thank you. Again, Michael Barron is the author of Subtle Acts of Exclusion, How to Understand, Identify, and Stop Microaggressions. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.